from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. What can the demise of the Roman Republic tell us about the vulnerability of modern democracies? That's one of the questions that UC San Diego historian Edward Watts tackles in his new book, Mortal Republic, which looks at why Rome, once economically prosperous and politically stable, descended into violence and one-man rule. We'll talk about what he sees as the Roman Republic's early signs of sickness and what leads citizens accustomed to democracy to embrace an autocrat. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Historian Edward Watts' new book, Mortal Republic, begins in the 3rd century B.C. when Rome developed democratic institutions that allowed it to expand its territory, grow economically, and remain politically stable. But by the late 2nd century, economic inequality, coupled with politicians, what Professor White calls constitutional trickery, led to violence and ultimately to civil war. Edward Watts, who's a history professor at UC San Diego, joins us this hour to talk about the collapse of Roman democracy and what it says about today's political realities. And we welcome you to the program, Edward Watts. Good morning.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I guess the place to begin is a little background here. Normally, when people talk about the fall of Rome, they associate it with decadence or they make analogies to the United States that we're going down somehow that same path. But you bring to light, and I give you kudos for this, a whole different story that certainly pertains to our present circumstances in many people's minds. This was a great republic. I mean, a lot of people don't realize how, as you call it, capable and effective and vibrant Roman Republic was. And yet it fell into autocracy. It fell into autocracy under Augustus. A lot of that, as you make the argument, had to do with, well, trading freedom for autocracy, trading the republic's democratic values for autocracy.
Yeah, I think that you make an important point. When we think about the fall of Rome, what we tend to think about is the fall of the Roman Empire. But before Rome was an empire, it was a republic. And the greatest success and expansion of Rome occurred when Rome was a republic. What we see when the republic ends is a moment where the political structures have become so unable to protect the life and property of individuals that Romans are, in effect, asked by the Emperor Augustus to trade what we would call political freedom for a form of security. And the Augustine argument is effectively one of the Republic can't protect your life or your property any longer. And so you have a choice between being able to exercise a form of political freedom or staying alive. And Augustus promises that he will keep you alive and keep your property intact. But in return, you have to give political freedom and political autonomy over to him.
Now, back in 23 BC, it looked like the empire was falling apart. There were natural disasters, there were food shortages and so forth. And so Augustus was, well, very gladly accepted as a dictator, virtually, or a tyrant, really.
Yeah, there's a very interesting step that Augustus is able to take at that moment. He recognizes that in 23 BC, it's important to remind everyone in Rome what it is that he provides. And he doesn't orchestrate these crises, but he makes it completely clear to Romans that the only way out of these crises is via his resources and his person. And so he reminds Romans, in effect, that bad things will happen, but the only way that Rome in the 20s BC or 30s BC can survive these things is through his agency and by giving him the power to decide how Rome will develop and what sorts of choices Romans will make.
Reminds us, unfortunately, of the kind of rhetoric we hear from our present chief executive who talks a great deal, or did talk a great deal, particularly during the campaign, about he was the one who could fix everything. But you're really talking in a broader sense here about how people, even in ancient Rome, would maybe sacrifice security or sacrifice liberty for security.
Yeah, I think that the argument that I alone can fix it is something that you see in the later stages of the Roman Republic, and it's absolutely the argument that Augustus will make. And it's actually the argument that Julius Caesar makes as well. But it's something that would have been extremely strange for Romans to hear in, say, the 3rd century BC or the 2nd century BC, when their republic actually was functional, and the idea of their republic was one of shared governance and a voice for everybody in the decision-making and the processes of acting politically within the Roman state.
You talked about the concern that came across that Augustus was going to preserve property rights. You also talk a good deal in the book about freedom from foreign powers. Let's find out what that was all about. I guess it was about Antony and Cleopatra to some degree, wasn't it?
Yeah. So the final civil war that the Roman Republic fights, the one that dooms it, is a civil war between the man who will become the Emperor Augustus and Mark Antony. And the story to that is somewhat complicated. Both of them are, in a way, heirs of Julius Caesar. Augustus is the actual legal heir of Julius Caesar, and he takes Julius Caesar's name. Antony believed that he was the political heir of Julius Caesar. And what that means is they, at various points in the late 40s and early 30s BC, they try to fight, and their armies, both of whom were loyal to Caesar at one point, refuse to fight each other because they're both Caesar's. Yeah, they're both Caesar's men. What ends up happening is Augustus comes up with a way to turn Romans against Antony. And the figure he uses to do this is Cleopatra. And so Cleopatra becomes a foreign queen who has taken the Roman Antony and made him into something different and something less Roman. And this allows Augustus to frame the war against Antony not as a civil war, but as a foreign war. And it becomes not a war against Antony, but a war against Cleopatra, who has, in a sense, captured Antony and de-Romanized him. And so the argument Augustus finally makes for conducting this war against Antony is that Antony is no longer, in a sense, Antony. He's no longer the Roman that you remember. He's instead a captive of this foreign queen. And therefore, it's a foreign war. And the war, when Augustus wins it, is celebrated as a victory over Egypt instead of a battle within the context of a civil war against another Roman.
But August was also delivering Rome from the senators who actually took power via murder of Caesar, didn't it?
Yeah, this was his other genius, politically genius move. Caesar was killed on March 15th of 44 BC. And after this happened, no one in Rome really understood how to react to this moment. You know, Caesar had guaranteed security. He'd guaranteed stability. And with his murder, it seemed like that guarantee was now gone. And so people in Rome were very, very concerned about what would happen next. And Antony was in Rome. The assassins Brutus and Cassius were in Rome. Political figures and senators like Cicero were in Rome. And in the days after Caesar's murder, they work out a compromise that says that Caesar is to be honored as a god, but his murderers are to be absolved of any blame and any problem. And so what that does is it compromises every member of the Roman political elite at that moment. But Augustus wasn't in Rome at that point. And so when Augustus does assume the title of Caesar's heir, he's not tainted by any compromise with the senators who had participated in the murder of Caesar. And this gives him the political space to say that I alone am the true and uncompromising heir of Caesar. And this is how he begins to build his political brand. And Antony's willingness to compromise was something that he would never completely recover from. He was always the follower of Caesar who was willing to allow the murderers of Caesar to get away with it.
Talking with Edward Watts, and Edward Watts is the author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. He's also a professor of history at UC San Diego. We'll get back to Rome, but first, there's a kind of warning flair that goes out in your book about, and you mentioned political brand, and of course Trump has established his own political brand, and I got into a pretty intense argument about your book over the weekend because I was saying essentially what Sinclair Lewis said many years, it could happen here. He said it more about fascism, but I was making that thesis applicable to what happened in Rome, what you describe happened in Rome, an undermining of a republic because of autocracy. And the person I got in an argument with said, no, that couldn't happen here because we have checks and balances and it's too unlikely and the people would never allow it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, So Rome had checks and balances. The way that the Roman constitution was set up had actually, in some ways, more checks and balances than we do. The Roman magistracy that would be closest to the presidency was something called the consulship. There were two consuls at all times. In fact, every Roman magistracy, aside from the emergency office of the dictatorship that was only supposed to be held for 6 months and then let down, every other magistracy had paired magistrates who checked each other. And then there were checks within the system that prevented, say, a magistrate from doing something without the permission of a legislative body. And so what you have in Rome is actually a more severe system of checks and balances than we have in the United States. But the founding fathers in the United States were deeply influenced by the political structure that they understood to prevail in Rome. And so there's a Roman political theorist named Polybius, who's actually a Greek, but writing about the Roman constitution. And his argument, in effect, is that the best principles of all constitutional forms of government are present in Rome in a way that enables all of their best features to become apparent and to act on the state, but all of their worst features to be checked by each other. And so I think that the idea that we are immune to Rome's fate because we have checks and balances, it almost misses the fact that we have checks and balances that are in some ways patterned on the Roman model. Rome, in a sense, helped inspire that system of checks and balances that we have.
But what about our institutions that give fostering to rule of law, or the fact that we have essentially a system that supposedly won't allow for this kind of autocracy? And many people believe that that's unlikely or impossible because of the system we have.
So I think that the one thing that Rome shows us perhaps better than maybe anything else, a system in a republic that is strong and stable and long-standing takes a lot longer to degenerate than a republican system that's young. So in the aftermath of the 2016 election, a lot of the comparisons that we saw, a lot of the tools that we were introduced to so we could think about the consequences of the election and the political moment, were tools drawn from the weak and young republics of the 1920s and 1930s, you know, things like Weimar Germany or the Spanish Republic. The problem is that they are, of course, weak and young. And so everyone in those societies remembers a different form of government. And that form of government has yet to prove itself as a legitimate and capable form of government. But in an old republic, the republic has proven itself, and people are used to the ideas of it, and the republic is much more robust. That doesn't mean it won't fall. The Roman Republic was functional, stable, and saw no political violence for nearly 300 years. But once political violence did become a part of Roman political life, the republic still endured for another century. Its degeneration was very slow. And I think the United States is a lot closer to the Roman model than it is to Weimar Germany. I think the danger in the United States is that if we use a model that comes from the 1930s, if we make it through 5 years or 10 years and nothing happens, we'll assume everything is good and we'll move on and not worry about the state of our republic or its health. And what Rome shows is in an old republic, the process of degeneration takes a very long time, you know, more than one lifetime. And there are a lot of moments in that process where it looks like things have stabilized, but the process hasn't yet concluded. Rome hasn't yet escaped the danger. And I think the danger in the United States is that we may be in the end of the beginning of a very long process that will erode our republic. But we can't be complacent about the fact that our republic will be there forever just because it hasn't fallen.
Well, you said the first sign of sickness, talk about the health of the republic in the Roman Republic, was a misuse of tools and tools that provided strength to the republic. And you talk about what you describe as constitutional trickery. Can you define these tools in this constitutional trickery amounted to?
I think that the best way to say it is in the Roman Republic, there were laws about who could do what and what political activities were supposed to be performed by what individuals. But most of how the Republic worked was a system of conventions and norms. So, for example, the Senate actually had very little official power to approve legislation, But the Senate weighed in on legislation and said whether this legislation was good or bad. And generally speaking, people in Roman political life valued that input and acted along the recommendations that the Senate made. But that's a norm. It's not a law. And so there was the potential to say, we don't care what the Senate says. We're going to do something anyway. And what starts to happen in the second century BC is a lot of these norms that have governed the informal interaction between magistrates and assemblies and the Senate, those norms start to break down. And people stop following them, and people start challenging them. And in all of those constitutional contexts, there are gray areas that the norms provide guidance for how one ought to behave that, in a sense, laws do not. And we have this in our system as well, especially in the Senate, where there are a lot of conventions that have guided how the Senate behaves, but they aren't legally binding. They're just conventions that are observed. And the constitutional trickery is when one starts looking at these conventions and saying, yes, we've done it this way for a very long time, but there's no law that says we have to do it this way. And it will advantage me at this moment to ignore that convention and do something different.
Well, when you speak of conventions, it brings to mind the fact that we have what's so often described these days in our own republic as new norms that we never had before. And I want to sort of flesh out the kind of parallels that you've been talking about and writing about here, because there was a civil war within a couple of generations in Rome, and there was also, I remember my Shakespeare Julius Caesar well enough to remember that the mob violence was so out of control that they knew one of the conspirators was named Cinna, and there was a poet named Cinna, and they decided to kill him because he had the same name. And mob violence plays a very significant role in all of this, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that that's a feature that, of course, we don't have yet, and hopefully we don't ever have. In Rome, mob violence really begins when it becomes clear that the political system is not able to function effectively according to the terms that the political system has set. Violence becomes a political weapon when it's clear that the political system, first, won't be able to punish it, and second, won't be able to reach a decision that the people engaging in that violence are comfortable with. What the Roman Republic shows is that for centuries, a model that encouraged consensus building and compromise would bring enough people on board so that there was a general sense that political decisions were being made on the basis of wide political opinions and wide popular support. And when you get to a moment where that doesn't seem to be the case, violence does start to become an option. And as you get through the later republic, politicians begin to recognize how to use threats, intimidation, and ultimately violence more and more efficiently. So by the time you're in the moment of Julius Caesar, this is something where politicians are very well aware of how to mobilize a group of supporters, how to arm them, and how to use them tactically to bring about a political objective that can't be achieved through legislation. Instead, it must be achieved through intimidation.
And the violence continued to erupt and continued to escalate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially between 19 and 21 BC, which is really where we're focusing on here. What about, could you say something about what you write about, a trial of a Roman commander who actually attacked without legal authority, and Augustus got involved in it and appeared at the trial?
So the structure that Augustus wants to put in place as emperor is one in which the republic functions and in every way that it doesn't directly impact Augustus's exercise of power. And it's actually politically a very insightful move, because Augustus doesn't want to be held responsible for, you know, traffic problems or bad roads or things that really will happen anywhere for any reason. And so he turns a lot of authority over mundane things back to the Senate after he takes full control of the Roman state. And he retains for himself responsibility for the things that he deems to be really essential, mainly military commands and control of the army and provinces where armies are stationed. What happens in that particular moment is a commander who is supposed to be working under the command, under the authority of Augustus, in essence goes rogue. And does his own thing. And in the Republic, things like that happened. Caesar's war against conquest of Gaul was a commander effectively going rogue. But Augustus can't allow that. And so this was someone testing the boundaries of this imperial system. And Augustus couldn't slap him down in the way that, say, an emperor 200 years later would slap him down. He had to still pursue this issue in a way that a population familiar with the Republic would understand. And so there is a trial that says that this person has acted illegally. And in the rules of a Roman trial, Augustus is called to the stand and he's cross-examined aggressively. And what Augustus is able to do in that moment is, you know, he does secure the conviction of this person because that was a given. But what Augustus then does is he leaves the city of Rome and he allows some of the chaos of the late Republic to come back. And Augustus intentionally steps back just enough that he can remind Romans of what the Republic actually looked like, a place that was chaotic, where decisions couldn't be made, where problems couldn't be solved. And then he introduces himself back into the environment to solve the problems that he had allowed to emerge.
Of course, the verdict was not unanimous in that trial, was it?
No, no. And to him, that was a very clear warning sign that Romans needed to be reminded of what it was exactly that Augustus provided.
Augustus was quite the pragmatic and in many ways trenchant politician.
I think the amazing thing about Augustus is during the civil wars, he was incredibly vicious. The killings that he engaged in, the confiscation of properties of entire towns. He was an absolutely vicious civil warrior. And it's very rare to find somebody who is that type of person who wins a civil war and is able to transition into a political figure who can rebuild a political system. And the real achievement of Augustus was having a first phase of his career where he was as vicious as any Roman ever had been. And then a second phase of his career where he is able to bring about some sort of reconciliation and stabilization of this society that he played a large part in brutalizing and destroying.
Actually, there's a wonderful story by an author who is familiar to many of my listeners because she's been on here a number of times and is a friend of mine, Isabel Allende, which takes that tack exactly. I mean, of someone who is so vicious and ruthless and murderous, homicidal monster, and who then becomes a really, like Augustus, a very clever political tactician. I'm going to give out the phone number and invite those of you who are listening to join this conversation. We're talking again with Edwin Watt, who is the author of a book called Mortal Republic. It's subtitled How Rome Fell Into Tyranny, and he's professor of history at UC San Diego. You may have questions about how the Republic of Rome fell into tyranny or the analogies to today, which Professor Watt does draw upon to some degree, and not only applicable to the United States, but France and Venezuela and certainly other republics. There are many of them around us. You can join us now at our toll-free number, and we welcome your calls. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program and join the conversation with your questions or comments. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment and have your say that way, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Edwin Watt. He is a history professor at UC San Diego and author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. And we do invite your involvement into the program. And you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let's get our first caller on, and that's you, Rob. Join us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm hoping that we don't fall into this situation, but boy, the fact that so many people in this country have guns scares the heck out of me if that possibility were to come true.
Well, there is, you know, there has been talk from the right, extreme right, about civil war here. And do you see any analogies, Professor Watts, there with all the guns that the caller is bringing to our attention, which we need to obviously be aware of?
Yeah, I think that's certainly concerning. If there is an outbreak of civil violence in the United States, there's certainly a capacity to to make use of a lot of the weapons that are in circulation. I think that the idea that we're on the verge of civil war is probably at this moment overblown. I just don't think there are a lot of people who want to do that. And that's a key part. You have to have enough people willing to say that we don't value the political process. We don't value the peaceful exercise of our political rights. And we don't feel like this political system is salvageable. Those are the moments in Rome where you get civil war. And you have to have somebody who is willing to lead the call for that, you know, willing to mobilize those people on his or her behalf. And I think we're still a long way from that. But does it mean it's impossible? I don't think it's impossible. But I do think that the process in the United States, because we have a robust political culture and a robust republic, I don't think we're there yet.
Let's take some more of your calls. We go to Guillermo next in Oakland. Guillermo, welcome.
Oh, thank you for taking my phone call. So what's fascinating me in listening to your conversation is that Romans had a freedom of expression. They were able to communicate, to inform the citizens about what the government was doing, how they do it, and that's how the betrayers also became angry, because people were angry about whatever he's doing, right? So it told me immediately, because all the information that we have now from 2,000 years ago, they were writing documents. There was the freedom of express yourself and to say something and to write it. And in 2,000 years from now, forum is going to be like that. You say, well, we find this on forum. So it fascinates me that exists. And I'm sure in your resources you find out that information as well.
Well, thank you for the call, Guillermo. How much did the Romans have actual free expression, as you see it, Professor Watts?
So in the Republic, they absolutely had free expression. There were certain people, of course, who had a bigger ability to convey their ideas. And if you did want to have a policy discussion, say, this was something that had to be scheduled and you had to have permission to go and do this. But everyone from the leading Roman politician down to a humble Roman citizen was completely free to have an opinion about political ideas and to speak about it and to vote in accordance with those opinions. And so legally, everyone had a complete freedom of expression. This wasn't regulated in any way aside from slanderous speech or speech that was designed to encourage violence during the Republic. And so in that sense, I think that what we see is something that is again, quite similar to what we have in a modern context.
Now, here's a comment from a listener named Yasmin, provocative comment. Let me read what Yasmin has to say. Let's not forget that the Roman Republic was not a democracy, but an oligarchy where the common people did not have significant power. The rhetoric of the ancient writers bemoaned the loss of political freedom because the aristocracy lost their power to Augustus, not because the general public lost political power. Professor Watts.
Well, I think that's completely true. Yeah. A republic is designed to channel the voices of individuals through representatives. And the United States is a republic as well.
And it's also an oligarchy, isn't it, the United States?
Well, you know,
I mean, you can make that argument, yeah.
In California, you know, our voice for a presidential election is less powerful as an individual Californian than someone who lives in Wyoming. And that's by design. A republic is designed to have the voices of all of its citizens channeled through representatives who can act on, in theory, behalf of the largest number of those people. But it's absolutely not a democracy. But this also is not designed to be a democracy. The United States is a system in which we elect representatives who make policy on our behalf and serve, in essence, as the collective voices of the people they represent. And Rome is the same way. But the people who represent Romans, yes, they tended to be wealthier. But they did also, as a theoretical component of what they're doing, represent the voices of all of the people who voted for them. Just some voices mattered a lot more than others. And again, I mean, this is the bargain that one strikes when one sets up a republic. It is not a democracy, and every voice does not matter the same way.
And again, we're talking to Edward Watts, author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny, and professor of history at UC San Diego. And getting a number of questions and comments, Professor Watts, about the Gracchus brothers. Let me read you one from Charles, who says, in terms of diagnosing where the real fissures in Roman society began to crack open, what, if any, significance do you attach to the attempts of the brothers Gracchus to challenge the nobility as well as their subsequent murders?
I think that this is recognized by everybody at that time and probably every Roman historian subsequently as a really key point of inflection for the Republic. But I think it's important to distinguish between the two Gracchi brothers. The older brother is Tiberius Gracchus. And Tiberius Gracchus is a politician who was brought up to assume and hope that he would achieve the highest offices in the Roman state, in large part because he was part of the establishment. And as a figure who belonged to the establishment, he had a particularly conservative viewpoint at the beginning of his career. And he eventually had a falling out with the figures who belonged to that establishment and pivoted very rapidly and radically towards a position that we would see as more populist. The way that he brought this transformation to bear on political life was by proposing a set of reforms that did not have consensus support. And what Tiberius Gracchus did was violated a number of political norms and would do this in a way where he would have intimidating supporters and other figures around him. And in this way, really broke with the way the Republic was supposed to work and the consensus-building mechanisms the Republic was supposed to encourage. In the end, Tiberius Gracchus was assassinated by his opponents, in large part because they feared that while he never had used violence, he might. And this was the first outbreak of violence in Roman political life. Now, Tiberius's brother Gaius was, I think, a genuine reformer. After Tiberius's murder, Gaius had no illusion that he would be anything but a populist, and he had no illusion that he would be able to bring about anything through compromise because his name was Gracchus and there was strong opposition. But Gaius, I think, genuinely believed in radically reforming the way the Roman Republic worked and making it more representative and responsive to the needs of its citizens.
Which sounds to some people like Bobby Kennedy, and they make the analogy of the Gracchus brothers to the Kennedy brothers. Any credence?
Perhaps one could. You know, I think that the challenge with the Gracchus brothers is, I think, in my view, Tiberius Gracchus is an opportunist. And I think that Gaius Gracchus really genuinely embarked on a political career to make things better. And I'm not completely sure I would go so far with Bobby Kennedy as to say that that's entirely why he was doing what he was doing.
Well, he had a cruel change of heart. I mean, we had couple of biographers of Bobby Kennedy on the show, Lawrence Tyne and Chris Matthews, who also wrote a book. And they both say they're in disagreement on a lot of things, but they both agree that Bobby Kennedy really wanted to be a reformer and had a total change of heart from going from, you know, part of Joe McCarthy's prosecution team to being on the side of populist side and particularly people of color.
Yeah, no, I think that that's certainly true. I think that the remarkable thing about Gaius Gracchus is we're told that before he embarked on his political career, he was fully aware of the fact that he was likely to die by doing so. You know, in a sense, he did this and he understood that he was likely giving his life to make Rome a better place and to pursue a certain type of reform agenda. And I think that's a commitment that's very rare to find, or at least very rare to be able to document. And in his case, we do have a lot of material that says that he does seem to have embarked on political life with the full awareness that as a Gracchus, he was likely to give his life up because of it.
Let me go to another comment from Simon, who a question. Would your guest comment on a theory posited by Jared Diamond many years ago that the fall of Rome was fundamentally an environmental degradation of the soil? They essentially ran out of calories to feed the populace. Is this true? And don't we face a similar environmental crisis now like Rome?
So I will say that there's an excellent book by Kyle Harper that talks about this. I think that, again, we have to distinguish between the Roman Empire and the Roman Republic. When we're talking about climactic situations in the late Republic, this is actually something where the climate in the Mediterranean during the late Republic and through the High Roman Empire. So we're talking really the 2nd century BC through about, say, the 3rd century, 4th century AD. It's actually optimal for the production of food and the sustaining of that population in the Mediterranean. And so at the time of the later Republic, you do have food shortages, but those shortages tend to be caused by disruptions in the food supply and the network that gets food from places that produce it in quantity to the city of Rome, which at that point is a city of 1 million people and is very much in a situation of food insecurity. But once you have those supply networks put back in place or the blockages are alleviated, the Republic is very much able to feed itself. The resources are very much there to sustain that population, and the climatic conditions will be consistently able to do that for the better part of, you know, 3 more centuries. When you get into, say, the 5th century and the 6th century, you do have a pretty radical shift in the climate that does affect food production. And this occurs roughly at the same time that bubonic plague hits the Mediterranean. And so the empire is hit by a couple of things in rapid sequence that make it very, very difficult to sustain the level of population and the level of activity that the empire had seen in previous centuries. And so I think on that level, you do really do see radical differences that affect the ability of the Roman Empire to function. But you're in a period that's much later than the end of the Republic.
Again, our guest is Edward Watts. His book is about the Roman Republic, and it's called Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. He's professor of history at UC San Diego, and our next caller is joining us, and that's you, Tony. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to learn whether there was ever an occasion in ancient Rome when the judiciary successfully removed an unjust ruler.
That's an excellent question. So I think that I don't remember offhand a case where someone was successfully removed by the judiciary, but there is a difference in the Roman context because the judiciary is not, in effect, a standalone branch of the government like we have in the United States. Prosecutions were conducted by individuals, and the jury consisted largely of senators and, in some moments in time, Roman knights. And so that means that there isn't an independent arm like in the United States that can conduct these sorts of prosecutions. But you do have a number of moments where people who've behaved unjustly in office are prosecuted for that. And those prosecutions, there is a high bar to be found guilty in those kinds of situations, largely because, as I think Yasmin had said, you have an oligarchic system where members of that oligarchy are voting on the guilt or innocence of other peers who also belong to this upper class. But it does happen. And for example, the Roman politician Cicero makes his career by leading a prosecution of a governor named Verres, who was charged with extortion and misconduct. And so it is a system that is capable of punishing unjust or illegal activities by magistrates. But it's not one that regularly has the capacity to, say, remove people from office for that kind of misconduct.
Again, if you just joined us, our guest is Edward J. Watts, and he is the author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. You can join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website at kqed.org/forum. I think it's important also to emphasize, Professor Watts, that this is an incredible territorial and economic expansion right after the defeat of Hannibal, as you note in your book, in 202 BC. Rome just grew to this immense political and military power in the Mediterranean in the 1st and 2nd century BC.
Yeah. So what I like to tell my students as a way to conceptualize this is if the Roman Empire at its greatest extent were a country now, it would be the third largest country in the world. It would trail basically Canada and Russia. All are part of more than 40 modern countries are in the Roman Empire. And that's everything from Russia to Saudi Arabia to Morocco to, you know, the edge of Scotland. It's incredibly difficult to build an empire like that, that lasts as long as the Roman Empire does. You know, there have been bigger empires in the history of the world, but they don't last as long as Rome did. That empire was built largely in the second and first centuries BC, and it maintained its territorial integrity through the 5th century AD. So it lasted for the better part of 500 years without losing significant territory. And that's really remarkable. And what it speaks to is the ability of the Romans to come up with mechanisms to make that system work in a way that's stable and secure. And part of that comes out of the way that the Republic understood how to regulate expansion. One of the geniuses that the Roman Republic has is it understands that if you extend citizenship and political participation to other people that you have conquered or that you have come into an alliance with, you then bind those people to you in a way that is enduring and encourages them to contribute to your society. And this is a principle that the Republic does far better than any ancient state anywhere else in the Mediterranean world. And it's a principle that ultimately is extended across the empire until this idea of being a Roman and a citizen of Rome is extended to literally every free person in the empire in the 3rd century AD. This is a really remarkable testament to what the Romans were able to do in creating a political system that was simultaneously stable and expansive.
The comparison, Kathy writes, one of our listeners, of Rome to today's United States is a mirror that reveals so much about human nature. We profess and grow intellectually, yet our basest form remains. What's the real warning here to republics, as you see it, Professor Watts?
I think if we value a republic, we have to work to keep it intact. I think that we have, in many ways and at many moments, spoken purely on behalf of positions and politicians whose ideas we agree with. And we have adopted an idea that if we get a policy through that we like, it in a sense doesn't particularly matter the way in which that policy was enacted. And what I think Rome shows, and again, this is an analogy, but it's an important analogy. What Rome shows is we have to sometimes step back and speak for our republic. We have to sometimes step back and say, even though I value this idea or I support this politician, I don't like the way it's being brought about. It weakens us as a people and it weakens our political structure. And if we speak for that republic, we will defend that republic and we'll ensure that that republic remains. But if we don't speak for the republic and we pursue small or short-term interests at the expense of our political institutions, those institutions will get weaker, and eventually they will fail.
You're really talking about the commitment of citizenship, aren't you?
Yeah, on a very basic level, we have to, in a sense, have a commitment to the political system we belong to and the society we belong to, and understand that the rules and norms of this society need to be in place or we will not have norms and rules that govern society. And at that point, no one is sure exactly how their conduct will be rewarded or punished. And no one is sure what's at stake in a political discussion or a political conversation. And that's extremely dangerous. That's a recipe for violence.
Could you also say something more about the role of economic inequality in leading to mob violence? I mean, what was the scale of economic inequality?
So what we see in the 2nd century BC is something that's actually in some ways quite similar to the emergence of economic inequality in Western Europe and the United States in the 20th and 21st centuries. Rome develops a financial sector in the years, say, from the middle part of the 2nd century BC, in which people make loans, sell those loans, recapitalize and make more loans. And for a certain segment of the Roman population, this allows them to become fabulously wealthy very quickly. And this is profoundly destabilizing because it's occurring at the same moment that the economic prospects of most regular Romans have stagnated or begun to decline. And so this financial revolution creates a situation in Rome where there's simultaneously a group of people becoming more wealthy than anyone in Rome had ever been before, and another group of people who feel like their opportunities are becoming less significant and their opportunities to succeed are less than, say, what their parents had. And what the Republic struggles and ultimately fails to do is come up with a mechanism to address this widening inequality in a way that makes the people who feel like they are losing out instead feel like they are being supported and their interests are being taken care of. Now, the interesting thing is this burst of inequality really starts in, say, the 160s and 150s BC, and the political turmoil starts about a generation later. And that shows that there was tremendous faith among Romans that the Republic might find something to sort this out. But as you get to the 130s, you see not just poor people, but people who are relatively well off begin to turn against the idea that the Republic can solve this problem by finding a consensus and creating a compromise. And instead, they turn to people like Tiberius Gracchus, who promise quick fixes to the problem that are pursued through whatever means are required to bring those fixes into being.
Here's a question, Professor Watts, from one of our listeners whose name is Robert, who says, can your guests compare the consequences of Mitch McConnell today backing the president's emergency declaration after previously contesting it to the Roman example?
Yeah, I think that this is a moment that is really quite scary. You do have a set of norms and a set of laws, and it's clear what the emergency declaration is supposed to do. This is something that sets a very dangerous precedent.
The barbarians at the gates, we're reminded here. I mean, in terms of the way the Trump administration is framing it, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that the danger here is if this is allowed to stand, then invocations of emergencies can be used to do all sorts of things. And this is a point that has been made by Nancy Pelosi. It's a point that's been made by Rand Paul. It's a point that's been made by a number of people in Congress who say, in essence, that if this is allowed to stand, a subsequent president can do just about anything.
Democrat could do it with gun control and perhaps would if this is a precedent.
Or,
yeah.
You know, after a hurricane, declare the Green New Deal must be implemented because of a climate emergency. It's extremely dangerous to take this power away from Congress when this is supposed to be Congress's power. And I think that that's a danger on both sides. And it's a short-term win for Trump if this is allowed to stand, but the damage is going to be profound and long-lasting.
We're getting another Mitch McConnell example, refusing to allow a vote on Merrick Garland. Sometimes we get carried away with some of these analogies, but you've certainly managed to flesh them out and make it provocative for us to think about. And here's a listener who wants to make a statement about President Trump's use of the courts. Gary, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like your thoughts on this. Being in my 60s, I've been taught for the last 50-plus years that the reason for the existence of the federal courts and the Supreme Courts are to be tiebreakers in positions on issues that need a tiebreaker. And I thought that was a good thing. And then until last month when I was kind of shocked and sickened when I turned on TV and I heard Trump telling America that he expected court decisions and court cases on his decision to build the wall and finish the wall and the national emergency. And that he saw the outcome as being either the courts were going to side with him or they're going to make what, and this was the word he used, was bad decisions. And are we teaching America now that the courts aren't there to make the best decisions, that they're there to support one side or make a bad decision?
Now, this is a president who's certainly on a number of occasions undermined the judiciary, although he certainly pleased conservatives by appointing two conservative justices to the court. But eager to hear your thoughts on this, Edward Watts, particularly when we think of ancient Rome and the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I think that the way that the courts have been functioning, and I think Gary's way of putting this together is great. If the courts function as tiebreakers, this is wonderful because they are not political. They are, in a sense, like Supreme Court nominees like to say, they're calling balls and strikes. And this is a very, if courts do function this way, it's a very serious and very important distinction between what Romans did and what we do. It's much better to have courts that behave in this way. Because in a Roman context, courts became politicized. And across the last century of the Republic, trials largely became political theater. because courts didn't have this independence. They weren't just calling balls and strikes. They were really entities that could be used for political warfare. And our system that places courts above political warfare, or at least has for a very long time, is far superior to what you see in the later Roman Republic. It's a real danger if we move away from that. And if we go closer towards what you see in Rome, where courts are political weapons, that will really radically weaken the way that our society functions, and will radically weaken the rule of law in our society. And it, I think, will take away one of the very strong and important advantages that we have over society like the Romans.
Here's another caller joining us, Dorothea. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Two things I'd like your guest to comment on. One is that you're using the word republic, but you don't mention democracy. Are you sort of substituting the word republic for democracy? And the second thing is Constantine put the sword on this cross on his sword and went out and conquered. So could you speak to the issue of this idea of Christianity and how he used it?
Well, thank you, Dorothea. We've got seconds left here. But Professor Watts, the first question, I think, is very appropriate. A lot of people do confuse republic and democracy, and they're separate entities.
Yeah, I think we've conflated them in a modern context. But in the ancient world, there's a very clear difference. In a democracy, votes are taken in which every citizen has one vote, and a policy is decided upon based on the 50% plus one vote. And so it really is people making a decision about policy. And democracies are very dynamic. They move very quickly.
And this is a representative democracy. Now, quickly, because we've got seconds left, could you say something about Christianity and the sword and all that?
The conversion of Constantine occurs in the 4th century A.D., and Rome then undergoes a process by which it becomes a Christian empire. So that's the period we're in.
And I will have to say thank you, because we'll have to leave it at that. Edward Watts, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Good to have had you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Edward Watts is the author of Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. Stay tuned for more. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.